Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Questlove Supreme. I'm your host, Questlove. With me today is Boss Bill, and kind of weird is Fontigolo on his own former podcast as a guest.
The prodigal son has returned.
And the one and only Big Pooh, collectively known as Durham, North Carolina's finest little brother. I'm correct in saying Durham, correct?
Yep.
Yep.
And you claim Durham as well, Pooh.
Durham claims me.
That's real.
Like who's winning the tug of war of where the genesis of little brother actually lies?
It's Durham.
It's Durham. I mean,
it all started at Central. You know what I mean? We were students at North Carolina Central together, so Durham, for all intents and purposes, it is the birthplace of little brother.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just have to make it clear that I'm from Virginia originally. Just
what city?
Alexandria, all through Northern Virginia, but Alexandria and Fairfax specifically.
Okay, all right. Yeah. So I in the attempts to treat Fonte as a regular guest and not assume that everyone knows his story. I do, however, I'm not that familiar with your story, Pooh. So to give us a recap or whatever, I'll start with you. What was your entry into music?
Probably the radio, but like more importantly, BMG, when they did the, you could get like 10
CDs for a dollar.
12 CDs for a dollar or whatever.
Were you honest or were you a scammer?
I was scamming big time.
Yeah, proud scammer here.
Yeah, I did it about five different times and got five different groups of CDs. But that was probably my real intro, just learning about so many different artists. And I had friends from New York. I mean, everybody probably did at that time back in the 90s who would come down with tapes. Like, that's how I first heard of Biggie, Nas, and just different artists from out of New York at the time. And between that and radio, because radio was real regional in the 90s. So it was heavy go-go influence, but you would get, when the artists come through, you would start getting the different artists. So that's how I got put on to, like, when Raekwon, when he dropped the Purple Tape, he came through, did an interview. They actually debuted Incarcerated Scarfaces on the radio. I'll never forget it, in D.C. So that was my start, man. I was actually just talking about this with my wife yesterday. Like, we didn't listen to music in the house. My mom is not a huge music fan, so I just had to get it other places because it didn't come from the crib.
Yeah, I was going to ask, and the same for you, Fonte, like, was there trickle-down creativity in your life, like an older cousin,
Yeah, for me, it absolutely was. It was my mom. I think it started with my mom. So the thing with, I have very young parents. So my mother, when she had me, she was 15 and my dad was 17.
Right.
So I was pretty much with my mom, like, all the time. So wherever she went, I was there. So during the summer, during the weekends, that was when we had to clean up. We all live with my grandmother. So that was cleanup time. So that was when she was playing all the, the classic R&B stuff, Luther Patty. You had Johnny Guitar Watson. She used to like Love Jones by Johnny Guitar Watson. And we would sing that. And then during the week, if she went out to like the park or whatever, that's where I heard all like the early 80s, Nucleus, Jam On It, Shannon Let the Music Play. That was kind of where I was hearing all that. And so between her and my uncle, my one uncle Mike, he was a DJ, and he would get like all the promo records from the station and bring them home, and I would go through the promo records. And then my other uncle, my Uncle Brad, he was kind of the more experimental, I guess, in terms of his taste. Like, he was heavy, P-Funk heavy. He was a big dance music fan, so a lot of South Soul stuff. South Soul Orchestra, Instant Funk, Got My Mind Made Up. I remember he had like the Heart, the Dreamboat Annie album. You know what I'm saying? So he he went all over everywhere. So he was probably, you know, one of my biggest musical influences in terms of no regard for genre. If it was funky to him, he just fucked with it, and that's what it was.
So with Pooh, for you, you not having that, like, what was it, just recreational or just an escape, or like, what was your life plan?
It was an escape for me. I can put on music, had a bike, Walkman, just ride around town, endless hours just listening to music, had the auto reverse, so it would flip itself. And so, you know, it was just something I just always innately enjoyed and just enjoyed listening. I was always a writer, not necessarily of music, but like I would write poetry, I would write short stories. So that inspired, like that intrigued me in music. That's why I took to Nas like I did, because his rhymes are more like stories to me. So that's why I took to Prince. His stuff was like stories. That was pretty much it. I later learned that my dad is a big music head and fan. But, you know, I didn't meet him till I was 19, so I would not have known that in my younger years.
Now, I mean, is this the typical narrative for a young black teenager in the early 90s to go this particular route? Because, again, I mean, you know how culturally ignorant Northerners are. And what our thoughts are about anybody below the Mason-Dixon line. So, I mean, just in general, because Outkast had this problem as well.
Yeah.
Like, people just say, Atlanta, whatever. You know, not knowing. So, was there ever is this the typical route of a young black teenager in that time period?
I definitely wouldn't say it was typical. Just because, you know, where we grew up at, where I grew up in Greensboro, North Carolina, you know, there were people who made music, but there wasn't really the thought of actually making it as a musician. It was just, yo, we like music, we spin records, you know, we freestyle, whatever. But I don't think there was ever a real thought of like, yo, you could make a living doing this. This the South at that time, and still in many ways, is still very traditional in the sense of, you know, you go to school, you get a job, you get you some benefits, you know, you bring a steady check home, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
That was life.
That's what it was, yeah. So in terms of just musically, though, the South was always a big kind of melting pot because I think a lot of things that people didn't understand, the problem that Cast had and also, you know, a problem that Little Brother had, you know, people didn't understand it in the South. We grew up listening to everything. Like, the South was the meeting point for all kinds of music. So you had, of course, you know, where we were, and I've talked about this before on the show, where we were in Greensboro, that was, you know, it's the South, it's East Coast, but it was a lot of traffic that went through Greensboro, be it college students, be it drug dealers, be it, you know, just all kind of transplants that was bringing their music, you know, to our area. And then, like Pooh was saying, you had the cats coming from D.C., they brought the go-go, you know what I mean? And so we were getting, then you had Florida, that was, you know, Magic Mike, Two Live Crew, you had the bass, you know, from Florida and Atlanta. And then, you know, the West Coast, you know, with like Chronic, of course, I mean, Chronic was kind of the bomb that went off everywhere, but we were students. And that was something that I think we always had an advantage of as Southerners, because we really had to study all types of music versus New York. They kind of got caught off guard. Like, the South was a sucker punch to them. Like, when they saw, you know, when Master P blew up and, right, you know, No Limit, you know, Cash Money, they got caught off guard. It was like, what the fuck is this? But in the South, we knew that shit was coming. You know what I mean?
Right.
Because we had been studying it.
So, okay, when I first started coming down to North Carolina, there was a club called, is it the Cat's Cradle?
Cat's Cradle.
Yep.
Okay, so, like, one of our very first gigs was at the Cat's Cradle, and I mean, you know, we were the Roots, so of course we're going to attract sort of an alternative sort of audience, whatnot. So there was like an element of culture that I was familiar with down there that I wasn't too certain about. I don't know if you guys know Dave Tompkins. He was like a writer.
Yeah, he was a writer at I know of him. I don't know him personally, but I know who he is.
Yeah, he wrote for like Vibe and all that stuff and whatnot. So he was like showing me around North Carolina and whatnot. So, I mean, was there a first draft of a crew? Like, how do you two meet and amalgamate into what will eventually be known as Little Brother? Like, what's the circle?
I mean, we initially met in a dorm room. Tay came through in his ever bubbly personality to spit a rhyme he wrote for English class.
That's how y'all met?
That's how we met.
That was the first time we met, straight up.
Yeah, it was knock, R.A.
Knock.
R.A. on the hallway. Joe Wright. I remembered his last name today. Joe Wright, it was his room, and he used to just have mad people come in the room, and I was fresh on the hallway because I actually stayed in a hotel for half of my first semester in college. But I got there, we were in the room kicking it, and Fonte come in and was like, yeah, wrote this rhyme for English class. It's called No Apologies. And he starts spitting, and I'm just like, what? You wrote that for English class? That could be on the radio or some shit. And that's when he let everybody know he was quitting football as well. I didn't know he played football, but he was quitting.
Yeah,
but,
I got the fuck up out of there.
he was
wait, how
that
long
loose.
Did you play football for?
Man, I played football. I started playing football in the sixth grade. And I played all through middle school, all through high school. And I played my first 2 years in college. And I played fullback. And, you know, by the time I got to college, I realized that it was a much more of a, it was a commitment that I just didn't have. Like, I didn't love the game. I wasn't on scholarship. I didn't care. You know, I was like, why am I out here? Fuck this.
Was it a Friday night lights culture for football down there or?
with
high school football and college?
Yeah. It kind of was. I mean, it was a big, so the school I played for in high school, Page High School, we used to whoop ass. Like, we was the truth. And so my senior year, we got to the semifinals. And we almost took state, but we lost in the semifinals. But we always had a good program. And so it was something, I think for me, it was just something that was more social in high school. It was just, you know, I was a big kid. I had decent size, you know, decent speed. And, you know, I like to hit motherfuckers. So I was like, all right, fuck it. I play football. But once I got to college, that's when I was like, yo, this shit is a business. Like, you really got to be committed. And I just didn't have the love for it. And I was like, man, why am I out here? I love doing music. So let me go do music. And that was around the time that was when me and Pooh met.
That's when we met. And it morphed into different variations of what it ultimately became. It was a big ass group of us at one time called the organization. Then that whittled down to Gimme.
How many people were in the organization?
It was,
I don't
like,
know.
What, nine? So it was, okay, the organization, it was me, you, I guess Ninth was in it by default, I think.
I don't even think he was in the organization.
Was he in
That's
it?
The thing.
Okay.
Man, it was people, I can't even remember their names.
It was this organization. It was this organization. So I know definitely it was me, you, Joe. God, who, you remember Rosie?
Rosie,
she was like one of the girls. It was a girl we used to run with named Rosie who was MC. She was dope. Medina, of course, she was in that.
Medina was there.
What's the joke behind Medina?
She was an MC, and Medina was dope. And Medina and Sean Don, they had a whirlwind romance.
Tumultuous relationship.
And yeah, it was the original Chris Brown and Rihanna.
Man, oh man.
Oh, no.
Man, oh man. Listen.
Okay.
We'll leave that man to tell his own war stories.
Those stories are not ours to tell. But we were a collective of just MCs, and then we had Aziz Collins.
Aziz Collins.
He was our R&B singer.
Yeah.
Aziz, keep him hollin', Collins.
Right.
And then we had like somebody else that rapped. I can't remember who it was, but it was just a very loose, and I use that term loosely. It was very loose collective of people who went to school together, and We would just
go to each other rooms, freestyling and rapping.
Freestyle. And that was that was it. And then it whittled down to Gimme, which is me, which Jay, was... Sean Don.
Gimme is G-I-M-M-E?
Yep.
And
that was a dope name. Wait, what? That wasn't an acronym, was it?
It was. Of course it was an acronym.
Of course it was an 99, acronym.
Of course. Come on now. Come on. What did Gimme stand?
God, I murdered many MCs. That was one of them.
Yeah, we had a couple of them.
That was the main one.
That was the main one. God, I murdered many MCs. It was so many bad. We had so many bad like meanings for the acronym, but that was it.
I want a group to come out named Acronym, and the acronym stands for
Acronym. Accomplished character, resilient. Like, nigga.
Oh, y'all don't get that shit way the fuck up out of here. But it transformed into many different, took many different shapes, and I still remember this was always be funny to me. I mean, this was the moment that changed my rap career, but it's still funny because it's ironic how it ended up. Sean Don didn't come back to school one semester, so that was the end of Gimme.
Right.
And Fonte was in my dorm room, and he was like, yo, man, we got
to
talk.
He went to New York. He went back to New York.
Yeah, Sean Don went back to New York. So I was like, what's good, man? He's like, yeah, man, I don't see us being no duo. So, you know, you got to do some more work. So, but if you need me for something, just holler at me.
Oh, he tried to fleece you.
That conversation changed my rap career, man. It made me work. The hardest shit. Like, I never worked so hard in my life at something. But it's ironic because we ended up a duo anyway.
Well, during that period, I mean, how much would you say you were committing to your craft as opposed to, like, surviving, going to your job, and I'll write a rhyme maybe?
Man, I was surviving, man.
Yeah, yeah.
It wasn't serious for me. I still didn't believe that it could be more than just something we were doing in school at the time. Because I never saw this as a career for me. It was just something I loved to do. And that moment let me know, like, hey, man, you got to step your shit up. or you better start really going to class. It was one of those moments.
Yeah,
as y'all can see, I didn't choose class.
Yeah, that was the thing. I mean, I remember at that time because we were kind of, it was a pivotal moment for all of us because at that time, Sean Donnie went back to New York and Pooh was still, me and you, we were the only ones, I think, still in Durham. And you were about to go home that summer. We were all about to just go home for that summer. And
what year is this?
This is 98, 99?
Nah, this was probably two.
Was it 2000?
It had to be either 2000. It was 2001. Because that's the summer we.
Wait a minute.
You know what? It was 2001.
It was spring 2001. I went to Charlotte for the summer. And I was taking the train back to Durham because that's when the Justice League started.
Yeah.
That's when Little Brother became Little Brother, like that.
And that was in spring 2001. That was like Dylan was born. My oldest son was born. He was born December 2000. So, yeah, around 2001 spring, oh, nigga, my head was in a whole nother place. I was like, yo, if you ain't real about this shit, nigga, you better find something else because, nigga, I got a kid.
Yeah, I was going to say, when you have a kid and when you have real life situations, then how much pressure to pursue your craft? Like, what's the ratio balance?
Man, I was scared of shit. I was scared as hell. My son was born the end of December. He was Christmas Eve 2000, and so I ended up finishing my degree in that following semester of like May 2001. His mother ended up coming back, I think, the semester after that, and she finished her degree like in December. So we were young parents and we had no fucking idea what we were gonna do. You know, I had no clue, you know, what it was gonna be. And me and Pooh, we had started kind of making records. We had made a couple records as Gimme, and you know, I felt like we had something. It was dope. But you know, Sean Don went back to New York. Me and Pooh were just you know, kind of here. He was going back home for the summer, and he was going back home to Charlotte, and we had that conversation. I was like, yo, man, I don't really see us being a duo. But that summer, I remember Pooh went home, and that was it was this event used to call Fat City that a buddy of ours was having. His cat DJ DR, and it was like an open mic kind of freestyle thing. And Pooh, he put in work, and he came back that next semester, and his rhymes was just different. He was rhyming. I was like, nigga, you this shit sound good. You know what I mean? And I could just see he had really put that work in. I mean, and we all had kind of been putting it in, but I really just saw in him, I was like, yeah, like he really about it now. And, you know, we all, you know, we took him seriously at that point.
Okay. So where does Ninth come into the equation of the original incarnation of Little Brother?
Ninth originally was, man, Ninth was, I met Ninth in 98. It was 98. So 98, we were moving into the dorm. This was like the day when everybody moves into the dorm. I was playing football, so I had already been there earlier to report for camp. So we had been in there, all the football players. But this is when the civilians, we used to call them, you know, the civilians had first moved in. So all the niggas didn't ball. Like, it's like, all right, it's the civilians about to move in, the civilians coming. And so Ninth,
sports at first, and then the civilians come.
Yeah, that's when the civilians come after that, because we had to report early, you know, for 2 days, well, shit, right. 3 days, really. And so, I'm in the joint. I walk into the dorm, and it's like the lobby kind of commons area, and I see this dude holding a Source magazine, and I was like, "Yo, man, let me see that. Let me see that Source." And at that time, this is like 98, so this is Master P. You know, Bad Boy. I mean, this is kind of like the peak of that era, you know, right. Approaching that era. So to see somebody with a Source magazine, that shit was like, nigga, that's like manna from heaven. You know what I mean? It's like, oh my God, you know about this too? What the fuck? You know? And so he was like, yeah, man. So me and him started going through the Source together, and it was a ad for Mos Def's Black on Black Size. And I think either me or him was like, yo, man, I'm waiting on this shit. And I was like, nigga, you know about that? Like, were you up on Mos? And from that point on, me and Ninth, like, we were, like, that was it. You know what I mean? It was like, you know, I had found kind of another Jedi. So that was 98.
Well, can I ask something?
Sure.
Well, when I meant culturally, did you often have to code switch musically to fit in with whatever social circle you were in? So say if like someone's not into Mos that is in your parameter in college, like who else are you listening to at that time?
No Limit. They ran shit. Cause
no fucking
No
limit.
Limit ran shit, bro. Like that was, for me it was different cause, so I didn't get No Limit until I got to college, because at the time, that was when we was playing football. And so all the football players, like all in the locker room, that was what we was bumping. Bout It, the True album, No Limit Soldiers. Like, you know, before we went to the weight room, like we bumped that shit. So that was when No Limit clicked for me. Because I was like, okay, this is what the music is used for. It wasn't necessarily nothing I was riding around in my car playing. You know what
so
I mean?
So at no point were you guys like, hey, there's this thing called the Love Movement. I want to play a song called Get a Hold, like drifting back, you know.
I was still in high school, but I mean for us it was just like you like what you like and you learned from other people about other, you know, other shit. So I learned from other people about No Limit. I learned because I was listening to New York stuff personally. So right. I learned from other people about No Limit. I learned from other people about the West Coast. I had a homeboy who was from Oakland originally. So he put me on to Drew Down and Too Short and all the guys from Oakland. And so that's how I started just taking everything in. But it wasn't like if you come into the circle and you be like, yo, man, I listen to you know, the Jungle Brothers, and somebody was like, man, I'm listening to fucking N.W.A., man. Like, it wasn't a thing like they looked down on you. It was just like, oh, well, let me see what that's talking about. And you, it was like a sharing experience.
It was a way, a lot more sharing, way more communal experience.
Like, we got in the No Limit, but it was more like with binoculars. Let's see what they're doing
from a distance.
Let's see what they're doing. I mean, when the movie came out, we had it on the tour bus, but it's more like, look at those guys.
Yeah,
but I didn't realize that that shit was a culture.
It was, man. Yeah, it wasn't a movement, nigga. It was definitely a culture. Like, and
you saw that No Limit tank.
Yeah, No Limit is an army.
Get the fuck out the way.
And yet, the thing that's curious to me is that you guys still decided to go to another pasture that not traveled before down there, where it could have been easy for you guys to just go that route.
I just think that wasn't who we were, you know, because I've been asked that question a lot about, you know, why we chose the route that we did. And, you know, for me, I think it was just an extension of who we were. You know what I mean? I mean, the No Limit stuff and like a lot of the South stuff that was popping at that time, you know, I enjoyed those records and, you know, they certainly had a place in my life, but I knew I couldn't live that. You know what I mean? And so I was like, well, the stuff that is more connected to me in terms of, you know, just who I am as a person and kind of where I want to live my life, it was Tribe, it was Calm, mm-hmm. and the Roots, and, you know, it was all the stuff from that kind of native tongue tree. And that was what felt right to us in terms of making records.
Now, I'll say what attracted me to you guys when I first heard of you guys was the fact that, well, first, I mean, our listeners need to know exactly how ahead of your time you guys were as far as, I mean, what people are doing now as far as, like, do-it-yourself, as far as doing stuff for yourself, making records, making final product in your houses, in your apartment, that sort of thing, which, I mean, it's practically unheard of. I mean, for all the folklore of RZA, you know, making the Wu-Tang stuff in his apartment, he still brought those ADATs to a real studio to polish them and all those things. So the first, you know, when you guys told me that all this stuff was made in your dorm room and on Fruity Loops and on computers and all that stuff, like, that was like talking Greek to me. How did you guys even know? I mean, how are you guys even pioneers of just new ways of recording and whatnot?
Shit, that's all we had.
We black folk, man. You know what I'm saying? Work with what you got. Like,
straight up.
We didn't have no studios. We didn't have no, you know, Knife didn't have no beat machine. Like,
at no point was it like, because even with us, it was like, okay, well, we got to get to a real studio one day. So, like, we ponied up our money and just went to a real studio. At no point was there like,
We heard what we had and what we were doing. It was like, fuck that studio. Like, this is our studio. And then, we good.
And then, too, on top of that, you remember, we heard the stuff that we were making in our studio, and then we also heard the stuff that was coming out of the big studios at that time.
Right.
And that shit was garbage. And so I think that kind of gave us even more confidence, because we was like, yo, if we doing this shit in my homie's apartment, and y'all niggas is going to these, you know, it was mixed on this 24 track or whatever, and the music still ain't good. So I think for me, that was a big factor too.
That's when I realized it was the man, not the machine. That's what that taught me.
What were the alternative group names besides Little Brother? I mean, was Little Brother just an automatic, like, that's what we are? Did you have other?
That was the first name.
Yeah, I think another one, the only one I can remember was Round Midnight. I mean, we had one.
We had one that we just all knew it couldn't be used for a rap group, Flea Market Mannequins.
I remember that.
That was one. I'm still using that shit for something.
Why is Flea Market
I have no idea where that came from. I remember that name, but I don't know what the thought of it was. I think maybe I was like, I was listening to like Goo Goo Dolls and like Foo Fighters. Like I was into that shit, so I was trying to think of a name that sounded something like that. But
an alternative name that could get y'all booked at a club,
right?
Wait a minute, what?
Right, be a lot of pissed off people.
So, what was the genesis of what we now know as the listening? In the beginning of it.
Man, the listening was, by this time, this is around 2001.
It's 01.
It's 01, yeah. I graduated school in May, and Ninth, by this time, he was fully fledged, like, making beats. So the thing with Ninth was that, you know, we met in 98. I didn't hear a beat from him until, like, a year later. I didn't even know he made beats. He came to my room. We met in 98. He came to my room one day, and he had he's like, "Yo, man, I got something I want to play for you." He's like, "Yo, I got the Black Star bootleg." I was like, "Word, you got that?" She's like, "Hell yeah!" And so we played the Black Star album. We was listening to the Black Star record, and I was like, "Man, this shit crazy as hell. This shit dope." And so then I didn't see Ninth again for like months at a time because he was in school, but I don't think he was really
but
in
he
school.
Wasn't in school.
Yeah, he was a career student. Like,
how do y'all do that? Like,
it's the
you
South,
hang around
man.
The dorms?
Yo, if you can, if you hang around the dorm, if you can get, you know, if you good with somebody in the calf, you can eat. So if you ain't got, even if you ain't got no meal plan, you know, you can get in the calf on especially on like Chicken Day, nigga. Come on,
yeah,
that shit
anybody
was a
walking in there on Chicken Day.
Yeah, wait, Chicken Day Essential was like the club.
I was going to say, at Tariq's school, they did not allow any Reynolds Wrap or foil inside their cafeteria for fear that, you know, the students would steal the food and take it back to their dorm.
Man, niggas took all kind of shit back from the dorm.
What?
We was taking silverware and everything.
I mean, we had a takeout line in the caf so you
straight
could
up.
Come and get your food and leave, like get it to go and leave.
Straight
oh,
up,
okay.
Straight up. But so around that time, you know, 99 Ninth wasn't on campus like that. I just kind of see him sporadically. But 98, he bring the Black Star album to my room. We listen to it. And then in 99, he shows back up. And by this time, we were in a new dorm. We were in the new residence. And so we had moved and we had like this little suite or whatever. And so he come and he like, "Yo, man, I got some joints I want to play for you." And I was like, and I was thinking he had like another unreleased album. And he puts the tape in and plays it. And I'm like, "Yo, this shit dope. Who is this?" And he's like, "Yo, this is me." I said, "Word?" I said, "These, like, you made these beats?" He was like, "Yeah, these joints." I said, "Well, what you make them on?" He said, "Man, I just make them on Fruity Loops." No. I'm sorry. It wasn't Fruit Loops at the time. This is even before Fruit Loops. He was using a program called
Sony Acid.
Called Beat. Nah, this is even before Acid. It was a program called Beatbox, and he was using Beatbox and Cool Edit to make tracks. And I mean, again, it was unheard of to me. I was like, "Nigga, what the fuck? Like, really on a computer?" And so, but he had some joints. And so one record he had, it was one beat he had. I said, "Man, would you let me rap over this?" He was like, "All right, cool." He said, "You really want to rap?" I said, "Yeah, let me rap over this joint." And I did a record called Paper Lines. And that was like 99. That was like the first song me and him ever did together. And I remember doing it. I played it for Pooh, played it for just Cats and Our Crew. They really fucked with it. And that was kind of when it all first started. So around the time, by the time 01 rolled around, that was when the league had all, we was just recording so much shit together and it was still just kind of loose. But by this time, had started work on a song. It was called Speed. And originally it was supposed to be me and Median. Median never shows up to the studio. And so Pooh was there. I can't remember if you had rolled with me to the studio that night or.
Yeah, I think you rolled. I came up on the train and I rolled with you.
Yeah, we came to the studio together. And I was like, "Well, shit, Pooh here. Like, you want to rock it?" He was like, "Yeah, all right, I'll rock it." And so we did that song together and that was it. That was just like,
so
yo,
the
we
speed
got something.
I know, that was our first joint together.
That was the very first song we ever recorded together.
Wow.
Oh, shit. Okay. Okay. So, also explain to me, who is in the Justice League?
Okay.
All right. I'm sorry. Should I say Justice League?
No. Is there an agreement? That sigh was to remember the names.
Right.
It's 15 of them.
How do you wrestle with that Justice League? And have y'all ever had a meeting, a collective meeting? Like, what the fuck?
I talked to Rook. I haven't talked to Rook in some time. Rook from the Justice League. But it was always love.
Yeah, it was love.
Yeah, at one point, me and Rook was talking. This was years ago. He was like, "Yo, man, we need to do a Justice League meets Justice League. Like, let's collab. Let's do some shit." And we were talking about doing it, but I know it just never happened. But it was never smoking.
Who was first?
I think we were first.
I think we were first.
Okay. Yeah.
All right.
Anyway. So Justice League members. Okay, so we're gonna do this the easy way.
Yeah, start with the niggas on the phone.
Yeah, me and Tay. Then you have Ninth. Then you have Sean Don. You have Sean Boog. Crisis. Egg Allen Flo.
The guy named Caesar, right?
Oh. That's seven. Cesar Comanche.
Yeah. Eight. I know him.
Flash.
Eccentric.
Wow, Eccentric.
Mike Burr.
Long time.
And some dude named Big Doe.
Legacy.
Big Doe.
Legacy 13.
Nigga, who did
Crisis?
I said Crisis.
You got Crisis?
I said Crisis.
And you shout out Edgar Allan Poe? And Edgar Allan Poe? Or
yeah, Edgar Allan Poe. I said
Edgar Allan Flow. Edgar Allan Flow.
Edgar Allan Flow. I said Poe. Okay. Yeah, Edgar Allan Flow.
The Raven.
Nigga, I think that's it.
We forgetting. So it's 15.
Who forgetting?
We got Mike Burr. We got Eccentric. We got Son of Urel. We got Burr.
Got Bird.
Cesar, we got Boog.
Cesar, Flo, Crisis. Boog, Leg, Crisis.
I think.
Wait, what about the away? You said the away team?
That's Crisis and Boog.
Yeah.
It's Crisis and Boog. I think we got everybody.
Median.
Damn.
Median. Yeah.
Another dude that showed up intermittently. Like, he would just vanish for like months at a time and then just pop back up. That's been Median's MO since I've known him.
Everybody needs a Malik B in their life. Just shows up and blammo, here he is.
That was him.
So with Speed, like, when is it the official, like, okay, are we a group? Or was it just like, okay, what is this? I mean, is it like a relationship where you're like, you know, like after the third date, then she's like, okay, so what are we?
We are farmers. Dun, 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 dun.
For that, I think like a day or two later, like we all just kept listening to the song and noticed the chemistry and said, hey, this sound good. Let's make a few more and see how it come out. And a few more turned into a whole ass album.
Okay, now I really want to, now that I've established the story, for those that not familiar, now I want to get to my real first question.
Okay.
Because even more than the Roots, like, okay, no, okay, granted, it's like 11 of us, but really the Roots are two people. And it comes down to me and Tariq. And 50-50 is a little bit more easier than 33 and a third. So... in the beginning, are you guys ever like, what is the democratic process of how decisions are made?
Man, at that time, I mean, I thought was a fairly a good system that got kind of, you know, corroded over time. But originally, you know, it was the three of us. It was me, Poor Knife, and Doe was our manager. So pretty much whenever it came down to do something, me, Poor Knife would discuss it internally, and it's three of us. So automatically somebody's going to lose. You know what I mean? Sometimes I lose, sometimes Poo lose, Knife lose, whatever. But whatever it was that we voted on, we would then go to our manager and be like, look, this is what we agreed on. This is what we're going to do. And that was it. Once Knife left the group, that was when things changed and we no longer had that kind of third swing vote, so to speak. So that was when, for me, I think just the group became very taxing because it was just
so
me
it's harder
and Pooh
as a
talking.
Twosome.
Yeah, it was. But yeah, particularly and harder as a twosome at that point, because at that point in time, me and Pooh hadn't really, I don't think me and you had really talked like that about what we wanted and about kind of
at all.
Like, we didn't have none of them conversations. So we were just making a lot of them decisions on the fly. And, you know, when you don't have a third person there to kind of help smooth things over in some ways, it made it really hard. But in the beginning, that's what it was. It was the three of us. We make a decision and then just kind of told our manager what we wanted to do with it.
So what were your initial goals for the listening? Was it like, okay, we'll have these collection of songs, we'll try to get a major deal?
You think it too much.
Chop it around.
It was, let's do these songs, sell them ourselves, and see what happens.
Yeah. Originally, we was going to do, put it out ourselves, because I was on, I think I had like a credit card at that time. I had my little Discover card, and we was on Discmakers, and I was just running numbers. I'm like, yo, so how much, if we just press this shit ourselves and we moved out the trunk, like I was, you know, doing it just in my mind, and I was talking to Ninth about it. Cause I remember we were in the computer lab at NC State. So another fun fact about this time, which I'm just now remembering, even though the listening was recorded on a computer, none of us had personal computers at that time.
Hell.
Like, none of us had personal computers.
It's the Bill Gates story.
Yo, bro, for real. Like, I didn't have a computer. Ninth ain't had one. Ninth was using, we was recording at Cesar Comanche's crib, and he had a compact Presario. So that was the computer. So whenever I wanted to get on, like, OK Player and shit, nigga, that was all computer lab. So my homie Median, he was a student at NC State, but, like, not really a student, but he had an ID. And so, you know, he was there. You know,
we used Leroy. We used Leroy's roommate.
Louis Jerome. He was the Kappa nigga. Pretty Lou. But we used his joint, and then like when I was at Central, like that my last year, that was when I was on the newspaper. I was an editor. I was the arts and entertainment editor on our newspaper. And so I would be in the computer lab all the time. You know, that's when I would get all my OK Player posts off. But after that, I mean, I was going home. Like, nigga, we ain't had no computers at the crib.
No smartphones. Shit, Tay didn't even have a cell phone at that time.
Yeah, I don't think I got my first cell phone to probably like, four? Something like that? Some shit like that?
Yeah.
Three, four?
Yeah.
Wait, Boss Bill, correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah.
No, this is literally the Bill Gates story. Bill Gates' story had a faulty ID that let him stay in the computer lab like 15 hours a time. To be in the computer lab during Bill Gates' day was like a taxing like $40 an hour thing. But he never got charged for it. So then he was like, all right, I'm going to stay in this motherfucker for 15 hours a day.
Get his
code and figure out how to turn this big ass room into a laptop. So basically sneaking in computer labs, borrowing other people's ID and whatnot. This is the Bill Gates story.
I wish we made Bill Gates money, but
really not.
But you know, fate didn't have it that way. But that was it. We was just doing those records. So at that time, yeah, the thought wasn't, you know, at least for me, the thought, it was just, okay, we made this record. Let's just get it out so people can hear it. And, you know, it was just I don't think no one had a thought of where it was going to go. I knew my life was going to change. Like, I can specifically remember the night when we finished everything and like we had the final mix down and sequence of the album. And I just sat outside my apartment in the car, just listened to the record. And I knew things were going to change. I just felt that we had something special. It wasn't like, you know, yo, we gonna be rich or we gonna be whatever. But I specifically remember having the feeling of just like, yo, like something is around the corner. I don't know what it is, but I know something's coming. And at that time, we just wanted people to hear it. That was the only MO.
What was the first sign of that assurance? Was it like your first out of state show? Was it like mentioning the source? Or like, what was that moment where it's like, oh shit, this is about to happen?
I think for me, it was when Benny B got in touch with us. Benny B from ABB Records.
Okay. So that was not your label?
No, not at all.
See, I always thought that ABB was your, okay.
ABB was Benny B from the Bay Area. They had put out like a lot of Dilated Peoples 12-inch. Mm-hmm. That was kind of their claim to fame. Dilated mm-hmm. Peoples, The Far Eye. They had put out like a, just a lot of stuff, and they were known for just moving vinyl.
Yeah.
And that was how a buddy of ours, a promoter out this way, Bum Rush, DJ Bum Rush, he had a connected ABB in Davis, a cat named ID. And ID heard our stuff on the net from all of us. We had posted it on OK Player and all that shit. And we had the little site. That was when Boss Bill had the John. He had the he had his site. He had posted up the joints up on there. So it was just kind of spreading. And so ID from ABB caught wind of it and reached out to Bum Rush and was like, yo, you got a line on these little brother dudes? And ID called my crib, you know what I'm saying, one day. And that's how we started talking. And that was how the ABB relationship, that was how we came to sign with them.
So, Bill, were you the OK Player that officially introduced OK Player to, introduced Little Brother to OK Player?
I guess, but I mean, I got it through Von P from currently Tanya Morgan. And like Von hooked me up with Eccentric, and Eccentric sent me like the Beats for Love joint Revisited. And like, so I was a Ninth Wonder fan first, and then I didn't even know about these two until later. Like, I think I heard Speed and Away From Me, like maybe like a week or two after that.
Yeah.
And then I was like, damn, what is this shit?
Slop Funk Dust too. He was another one. He was the one that really, because again, we had no computers, let alone a way to build a website or none of that shit. So Slop was the one that he had built like a little site for us, and he was like, yo, I can put some joints up for y'all. I was like, cool. And I was working at Blue Cross Blue Shield at the time, and he would call me. You know, he would DM me or PM me, as we would call it back then. And he was like, "Yo, man, like y'all joints just crashed my server. I gotta like everybody been coming to this shit." I was like, "Word for real?" And we just had like 3-4 songs up there. So Slop was a big part of that.
Was it you and Ninth, or you and Pooh, or were you alone?
Were you in that show with us, Pooh? I went to the Greensboro show. I didn't go to that one.
Okay. All I remember was that we were doing a show, and it was about to rain. And I remember we were having an argument backstage because Hub was bitching and said, we should cancel the show because it's electric and whatever. And I'm like, dude, you wear Timberlands. Like, no one's, you ain't getting electrocuted. And he like protested. I think he didn't play the show or like walked off stage earlier or something shit. And I felt bad, and I did something very uncharacteristic. Like, I'm never the guy that like goes in the audience and like, hey, how you doing? Thanks for, you know. But some said, all right, go out there and shake hands for the first time in your whole career. And I did it, and you put it in my hand. You reminded me that this was the little brother I read about on OK Player.
Oh, wow. Wow. Okay.
And normally, you know, anybody hands me a disc is instant, you know, coffee table coaster for me.
Weed plate.
Frisbee.
I'm about to break up my drawer on your CD, nigga.
I just throw it in the trash.
So. Right. No, I can't do that. I just leave it backstage. I don't know. Like, I'm kind of proud of my track record. Like, something, I was going to leave it backstage, and I looked at it, and I don't know if it was the fact that your handwriting, like your font or whatever you did.
Real bootleg.
Yeah, something spoke to me. I'm like, yo, he really put some effort into this homemade, this artwork. I was like, and I went back, picked it up, and listened to it. And I was like, holy shit. Like, I'm borderline jealous of this. Like, I like this shit.
Thank you, man.
And like, yeah, like, I'll say that I've only, you know, Jill, Blau, Slum Village, Cody Chestnut, and you guys, I'm sure I'm missing somebody else, but like something told me to listen to that shit. And that shit, like, that changed my life, man.
Thank you, man.
Because
thank
like you. I personally didn't think I would. At that time, I was concerned because there was the idea of a group existing was becoming
endangered.
And listen,
an endangered species. And I was like, yo, a real group, not a bunch of soloists. And, you know, from there, then I just saw the word spread and spread and spread. So when it, like, what was the decision to not go the slow and steady route and, like, let's get a deal through Atlantic and...
Poverty.
So as your own record label, all right, so what is it back then, what were the roadblocks and the potholes in being your own record label?
Distribution. You didn't have direct to consumer back then. But I think I can speak for me on this. My decision, I think if that experience would have been a better experience for us, it wouldn't have been a thing of, well, man, let's go get this deal.
It would have been straight up and down.
Shit, we good where we at. But the experience wasn't good.
Because so we didn't get like, paid. So that makes
the experience terrible. We still haven't gotten paid.
So can I ask? Let me ask. All right. So that came out, what, 2002, 2003?
Yeah.
2003.
Okay. So had technology as we know now in 2020 been available in 2002, 2003,
mm-hmm.
would this have been a different outcome?
Very different. I wouldn't have fucked. Personally, I wouldn't have fucked with no label had we had it. You know, had we back then, you know, we already had the means of our own production. So we owned our means of production. We could make it ourselves. You know, if we had a straight pipeline that we could get it directly to our fans and see the money back, man, fuck a label. Straight up.
But
you made a great point. You know, when you ask about what made us make that jump, you know, I really think and agree 100% that if our indie experience would have been better and we would have actually been like paid fairly and, you know, according to our contract, if we would have actually been compensated for our work on an indie label, I think we would have been much more hesitant about signing to a major. But at that time, you know, we put out the records and, you know, you hearing all this buzz and, you know, everybody saying, oh, man, y'all about to blow up, y'all do this, whatever. So then Atlantic comes knocking and it was a bunch of labels that wanted to sign us at that time. But
who had Atlantic reach out?
Well, Mike Caron reached out first, but we were told we got the word, not to deal with him. So like we met with Warner, we met with Jive,
It was Warner. Cause it's Tom Wiley. That was when we met Tom Wiley.
We met with, rest in peace, Chris Lighty and Peter Thiel over at Jive.
Chris Lighty tried to throw something at y'all?
Yeah. Chris Lighty, man. He came to
Dave Lighty took me and Tay out to the club. Took us to the Crab House and to the
Chris
club.
Chris Lighty?
Yeah,
Chris
man.
Lighty, bro.
Chris Lighty.
So the thing was, man, I'll never forget this shit, man. I remember being in there and because this is around the time of Chris Lighty, like G-Unit. Hollering on records, Chris Lighty, right?
Right.
So the thing was, man, so we went into the meeting. We had a meeting at Jive, and, you know, Chris Lighty comes in, and we're all sitting there at the table. It's Chris Lighty. It's me, Pooh, Doe, our manager at the time, and Wayne Williams, DJ Wayne Williams out of Chicago. We're all sitting in there.
Yeah. Williams from R. Kelly
Ring?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
R. Kelly, right. Chosen few DJs, Wayne Williams. You know what I'm saying? So he's in there. And so, man, so we talking and stuff. And I remember Chris saying, he was like, you know, man, I listened to y'all album. And he's like, yo, it tells a whole story. He's like, it's not just singles. He's like, you know, it tells a whole story. And, you know, I really think I love what you guys are doing. I think, you know, we can push it. And I was just sitting there. I was like, wow. And he was like, you know, man, I remember he was talking about 50. And he was like, you know, the whole thing with 50 was get ready to root for the bad guy. That was our whole marketing scheme. And I was like, yeah, it's like the movie Payback. And he was like, yo, I like this guy. I like this guy. You know, like it was funny. He was like, yo, I like this guy. And I said, yeah, it was like that. He was like, yeah. He's like, you know, that was my whole thing with 50. And he said, but I really like y'all. He said, y'all are like different from everything else that's out. And y'all really cut through the clutter. And he was talk. He started talking about his time at Def Jam. I'll never forget this shit. He was like, yo, he said, man, you know, when I was at Def Jam, he said, you know, I was fresh off the Mr. Smith album, so I was the prince of Def Jam. He was like, I could do whatever I wanted. He said, and so the next record I signed was this record called Crew. Now, me, you know, hip-hop fucking rap nerd, I'm like, nigga, Crew. I'm like, yeah, Dirty 30. I love that fucking album. And he was like, yeah, I like this guy. I like this guy. I'll never give him say this shit. So, you know, I like this guy. I said, nah, man, Dirty 30, that was the shit. And he said something. He's like, I'll never forget it. He said, yeah. He said, man, I love that record too. But just because you love something don't mean it's going to sell. Mm-hmm. And I was like, damn, that's the fucking truth. But yeah, man, that was just my only encounter with Chris. But I really liked him, man. I fucked with Chris. He was a straight shooter. You know,
that's where we wanted to go.
That's where we wanted to go for real. Do you remember Jive was like, they wanted to just re-release The Listening first.
And that was the problem. Yeah. They wanted because them re-releasing The Listening means they now take some ownership, if not all ownership, of the album. And Benny B from ABB wasn't giving that album up. And
I'm sorry.
Yeah, we
don't own The Listening. I get it now.
We essentially had to go where he was comfortable going. That's how we ended up at Atlantic, or we would have never went to Atlantic.
And the only reason, I know a big reason why he chose Atlantic was because Atlantic let him keep his vinyl rights. So Atlantic let him continue to press all the LB vinyl, but they retained the rights for everything else. And so that was how we ended up at Atlantic.
That's almost unprecedented. Heard of that.
Did he press anything up for the second album other than Loving It 12-inch?
There was a Minstrel Show vinyl, I think.
There was Minstrel Show vinyl, and I think it was another single. I got to look through my records. I think it was single.
Shit.
It was Say It Again.
Say It Again.
Say It Again. Yeah. I think it was Say It Again.
Yeah.
And then he reissued The Listening in the Minstrel Show.
A couple of years ago. This is like a year or two ago he reissued shit.
Didn't he have a courtesy to send us any of this fabulous reissued vinyl? Like, damn, you already ain't paying this, Playboy. You at least could have gave us some vinyl. Shit. That gold vinyl look good. It looks snazzy, you know?
I have to ask you a question, which is like I know as, not trite, but as, you know, as it not meaning something today as it once meant back in the 90s, but did it mean anything to you to see those 4.5 mics in the Source?
Hell at all? Yeah.
Yes. Yes. What? It meant everything.
Yeah.
Everything. Think,
yeah. Seeing the 4.5, seeing, you know, we got 4 on The Listening. Because again, this was something that, you know, this is pre, like, you know, social media, you know,
right, where before the blogs took over.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, we were literally hearing about this. So it would be like, yo, word is that y'all got 4 in the Source. Like, what, nigga, what? And then you see it. I remember, like, going to the, you know, grocery store and buying the Source. And you see it, and it's like, holy shit. Like, this is really, it's a real thing. And I got, like, the hip-hop quotable. And that to me was like, holy shit, because I grew up.
Wait a minute, what'd you get quotable for?
I got it twice. I got it one, the first time I got it was for the Yo-Yo, and then the second time I got it was for my verse on All For You, off of Minstrel Show. And that to me was just like, man, holy shit, you know, that was a moment. So yeah, that shit meant a lot back then. That shit meant a whole lot.
Yeah, I try to act like 4.5 mics don't mean nothing. Like, psh, fuck the Source. But, you know, it's still hanging on my wall.
Nah, 4.5. Yo, 4.5 is the real 5. I mean, me and you talk about this a lot, but yes, 4.5 exactly. Is the real 5.
It is. It is. Absolutely. So, in hindsight, how was the Minstrel Show experience? Because there was so much expectations and so much was happening. I meant, like, Hove was co-signing you guys, like, everybody was like, all the stars were aligned. Like, at the end of the day, what happened,
man? So have you been watching the Last Dance Bulls documentary?
I just got done watching it.
Okay, so
I watched it at 8 o'clock this morning.
Okay, yeah. So the thing about it is, like, at the time we only knew what we saw, so it was just like you just see the, you know, them going for the you know, the third championship in a row for the second time, but you don't see all of the underlying stuff that's going on during that time. And just like, yo, the concentration them motherfuckers had was amazing. And I look at the mystery show, it wasn't that dramatic, but it was dramatic enough for us. You know, I was 24, 25 years old at the time, hadn't really experienced a lot. And we're trying to record this album, major label, trying to keep maintain our sound, dealing with our own shit as a group at the time, because that was when the group really started to splinter during that time. And so you got all that happening, and then you have this album that people at the label say they're excited for, but you know there's some trepidation because of the title, and nobody, you know, all them white people, they don't want to deal with this shit now. You know
that? Oh, let me ask. Okay, so is this Craig Kelman or Julie?
This
or
is
like what era of Atlantic is this?
It's Craig
this
and Julie.
Craig and Julie when Def Jam
and
took over.
Is
Atlantic.
Lior there?
Yes.
And Lior's
Lior,
there.
Lior, Kevin. It's right. It's at the takeover. It's at the Def Jam takeover of Warner. And okay. So the real problem started before the ink was dry on our contract with Atlantic. Robert Reef Tulo was getting
if you say his whole name, then this might not be good. I was gonna say was Reef there, because he would seem like your biggest fan.
Well,
I love Reef.
He started there, and then when we went into his office after the deal was done, we saw the boxes in there, and he was on the way out. Bro, it was nothing more telling than we pulled up for a meeting one time, and we walking into the building. In New York, we walk into the building, and Rob and Reef is coming in at the same time. And he waiting at the desk. We're about to go upstairs. We like, yo, what you doing? He's like, man, I gotta wait to get let up. Our A&R.
Oh. Right.
Because he was no longer they let him get A&R of the album, but he was no longer employed.
Mans was not an employee of Atlantic Records.
He was
Rex.
Not an employee. Like, yeah,
he was a consultant.
This is how you're finding out?
Yes.
Yes.
We found out Reef was fired when we came, just like Bouzette, we came to the building and, you know, we realized that he had to get buzzed in just like we had to get buzzed in. We like, what the fuck? So what then we the get fuck? Up to his office and we see all the boxes and shit. We like, nigga, like, you really fired out this bitch. And, you know, and he was, I mean, I actually, funny thing, we actually saw Reef in New York, like, last year. We was kind of doing our press run, and, I mean, it's all love. I mean, it's, you know, right. It was, you know, I mean, everybody had to do what they had to do at that time, so it was no, like, hate or nothing like that. It was all love, but yeah, Reef bounced. That was when he bounced. I think he went to Shady, right, Pooh?
I know he ended up over at Shady 45, but it was just one of them things where, We're in the building, we're new. They don't know what to do with us, really, because we're unlike what they have or what they had, and we don't have an A&R. Our marketing guy, James Lopez, who now runs the Will Packer Productions. Yeah. So James Lopez was marketing. He ended up being our marketing, our A&R, our cheerleader.
He was all we had. Him and Ronnie Johnson.
Punching bag. Ronnie Johnson. Rest in peace to Ronnie Johnson.
Wait, can I ask, was Rig Morales there yet? Or was this before he came to it?
Rig came later. He was like a year or two after us.
Jay Brown ended up being there right before we left, because Jay Brown was Lupe's A&R.
God, this is like the Hollywood Shuffle of music. Like, literally Def Jam and Shady are just,
that's all it was,
switching characters.
Yeah.
So yeah,
shout
man.
Out to Julie too, man. Julie always was in our corner, and she was with whatever. Like, as long as we came in and showed her that we was passionate about what we wanted to do, she was with it. So
yeah,
shout out to Julie Greenwald.
Okay, so I love the title, The Minstrel Show, but Humor me. Why did you decide to go with the minstrel show?
Because we couldn't call it nigga music. Real shit. No, that was real shit. That was,
you wanted to call that?
We wanted to call it. We was Steve's like, man, what we call this shit? Nigga music. And that was like the run. We were with it. I think that might have lasted for like 3 weeks. And then we realized, okay, we can't call the album that.
They're not going to let us do that. We didn't even think they were going to let us do Mystery Show. But we
nigga, had nigga music in the pocket. It's like, well, you know, we did want to call it nigga music. It's like, to make the Mystery Show sound better.
Yeah. Oh, this is better. Wait, was there any red flags? Like, wait a minute, I don't know, because oftentimes I'll have to explain to white people what minstrelsy is, and they never know what it is, and then like they're already in the middle of, you know, the swamp. So like,
man,
what were people thinking at the time?
Man, at the time, I think they were. I mean, the one thing I got to give Atlantic credit for, you know, they let us do us, and so my 100%. Main thought in going into the minstrel show, particularly once we, you know, signed to Atlantic, my whole thing was we got to show our fans that we can still do us on a major label. Because around that time, you know, signing to a major label, in a lot of ways, it was kind of the kiss of death. You know what I mean? If you heard that your favorite band signed to a big label, the first thing as a music fan is your mind is like, oh, man, Interscope about to fuck they shit up. Atlantic about to fuck they shit up. You know what I'm saying? So our whole thing was, well, man, first and foremost, we got to show our fans that we can still be us, you know, unapologetically us on a major label. And so Atlantic, they stood behind that. You know, it was a gamble. And, you know, and they let us, the record that y'all hear, that is the exact record that we took out of our computer in Durham. And put out to the world. And, you know, from the stories I've heard just from so many cats on, you know, labels, that is something that rarely happens. Certainly wasn't happening back then, you know what I'm saying? And we learned.
Was it out using real facilities this time around?
Nah, or? This was same thing. It was same. We still recorded that one. I think by this time we wasn't recording in Comanche's crib no more. We had the chop shop by that point.
Yeah, we actually had an office space that we dubbed the studio, and that's what.
But
we
it was
recorded.
The same shit. It was a computer, it was
same,
a mic.
Same setup. Yeah. Just a communal space and not someone's apartment.
Yeah, but it was the exact same setup. We had a computer. We had a mic. We used the.
We had monitors.
We had monitors. We had monitors.
The same mic that I have in my setup right now is the mic we recorded the Mystery Show, Get Back, all that on.
But mix wise, Guru mixed it at baseline.
He mixed
correct?
It at baseline.
He mixed it at baseline.
Okay, that was probably like the only kind of upgrade, I guess. You know what I mean? Just that, you know, Goo, he mixed it baseline. But everything else, man, that shit was straight out of our computers. And, you know, that was what it was. And I think we learned a valuable lesson, too. You know, when you ask about, you know, what was the climate like in terms of us calling it the Minstrel Show or whatever. I don't even know if the people around, if the Julie and Craig and all them, I don't even think they got too much into the politics of it. I think they were just like, yo, this is something new. These guys are buzzing. Let's just throw it out and see what happens. And one of the things that we learned that, you know, me and Pooh learned and Pooh is even doing now, like in his career as a manager, you know, we were very self-contained. So we came to a label and in our mind, we thinking like, yo, we got our artwork done. We got our music done. We know who we want to master. Like, we came in with all that shit already. And in our minds, it's like, yo, we're making the job of the label easier. But what really happens is that you don't have anyone to root for you because they don't have, no one can lay a claim to your success. Yeah, like, no one can say.
They're not personally invested in it.
They got no investment. They got no skin in the game. So, you know, that's one of the things that for us, it was like, hell yeah. But it ended up being a liability when trying to come into the major label system because everybody is trying to look for a leg up. Every A&R nigga want to be VP. Every mailroom nigga want to be an A&R. So everybody's looking for that thing to hold on to that's going to be the star to take them somewhere else. And if they can't hitch their wagon to your star, then they don't give a fuck.
Now, I still remember we gave Sycamore so much. We gave him the petty that Babyface gave Teddy Riley the other night. Like
Sycamore down with Sycamore's
the DJ Sycamore.
Okay.
He was with Clue or what, who did he run with?
I remember who he ran with. I just know he was fresh. He was fresh A&R over there. And because the crazy thing is, hip hop wanted to be our A&R. But Craig Coleman wouldn't let us go over with Hop because Hop and G had the office over there. And Hop was like, yo, give me them. Give me Saigon. And it was somebody else. And Craig Coleman wouldn't do it. So he ended up giving us the Sycamore. And I remember us going to New York. We was working on, I think
but
we were
getting Get Back. It was
It became Get Back. And we went up there. And we were just so off putting the Sycamore, man. Like, man, we know what the fuck we doing, man. I don't even know why we up here with you, dog. Taking us all around all these producers and shit. Nigga, we don't need these niggas. Like, we I just remember that want, attitude man. That we had, man. And I was like, just like you said, just thinking back on it as a manager now with an artist that signed to Dreamville and Interscope and another one on indie label Mellow Music. I understand now how off-putting we were, and we didn't even allow them to treat us like stars. Like, that was a big thing I noticed as well. Because we were so self-contained, we didn't allow them to pamper us, if you will. And that, it is very off-putting to label folk, I have learned.
Yeah, because the thing is, man, like, and another thing too, like, I just kind of saw is like, how much the record industry at, you know, at that time, and I mean even certainly now, how much it perpetuates dysfunction and how much it requires that shit in order to remain a business model. Because, you know, like we were saying earlier, you know, what made us sign the deal, nigga, was poverty. Like, niggas was broke and shit. So, like, when I saw, you know, a couple weeks ago, months ago, whatever, when Meg was going through that shit with her label and all that shit came out and they were talking about Meg Thee Stallion and her deal, and everybody was just, oh, well, you know, why don't you just get a lawyer and why don't you just get this? And
like, is that easy?
Yeah, and it's like, nigga, you don't understand the consequences that the artists are living in when they sign these fucking contracts. You know what I mean? It's hard to think 2-3 years down the line when, nigga, rent is about to be due on the first. So, you know what I mean? So you can't, you know, the circumstances under which you sign this shit, you know, the record industry, the shit is pretty much a goddamn glorified payday loan. You know what I mean? It's it's more predatory lending than anything else. You know what I mean? So poverty and dysfunction, that shit is baked into their business model. So in a lot of ways, it becomes a liability if you're an artist that is self-contained, know what you want, show up on time, do your job, just do it, whatever, because at that point they have nothing, they can't control you with nothing. And we were those dudes. Like, we just didn't give a fuck. We was just like, yo, we make the music we want to make. If we don't get this look or that look or that look, who fucking cares? But so when you're a part of that bureaucracy, you can't be like that.
So let me ask, if say the outcome of the minstrel show turned out to be more rosier than what happened, would you guys have delved into your next step, which was like, for Pooh was like the Sleepers Project, Fonte, you're making Foreign Exchange with Nicolay, like you're doing these side projects. Still committed to the, well, I mean, then there's Ninth's departure, so his leaving to do more production and whatnot. Like, your next step was splintering up and taking a break for a while. But had the outcome been different, would you guys have even chartered off into that territory? Or
The outcome, the funny thing is, the outcome of the minstrel show didn't even weigh in, because the first Foreign Exchange and my album, my Sleepers album, were done.
They was already done.
Before. Yeah, that was done
Okay, I thought minstrel was 2000.
It was 2005.
Four, 2005. Okay, okay.
My bad. Yeah, my solo, my Sleepers came out in February of 2005. I forgot when that first form
Connected, Connected came out in 04. It was like fall 04, I want to say. Yeah, and we were working on those records like with each other, so it was never a thing of like, you know, if Pooh's like, I'm working on a record, I need a verse for it. All right, cool, I jump on it. He jumped on, you know, Foreign Exchange record. So there was always, you know, me just kind of being a student of the game, I always saw that groups that allowed themselves to kind of do their own thing, they seemed to work a lot better, you know what I mean? Like, even with, like, Gangstar was kind of my example where Preem was doing remixes for everybody, but Guru had Jasmine Taz. Like, that was his own thing that he did. And then they came together and do Gangstar. And so that was always my thought. So when it came for us doing side projects and solo stuff, even with Ninth, with all the stuff he was doing, we were all very much a part of that, and we championed that.
Okay. So without making this you guys' audio obituary, so then you... All right, so I actually want to cut in Tarantino this, skipping in the future, because I don't know the story of after me begging and begging and publicly begging. We've talked about this story before on the Solange episode of me trying to will a little brother reunion into existence. But what was the straw that at least... that unbroke the camel's back for you to be like, okay, like, what, you down? You down? Like, what was?
I think it was just us becoming friends. Like,
wow. Straight
we
up.
We just had to take time to, after we didn't speak for a while, we just had to take time to just become friends. And that just really, and honestly, like, for almost 2 years, we didn't discuss making no music together. We didn't discuss. It was more like, yo, how you doing in life? Like, what's going on in your life? And then eventually, once we did that show, the next day, it was unspoken. Like, I went to Tay House to pick my money up. And he was like, yo, I'm cooking. He said, I'm cooking. I said, I'll stay. You know what I'm saying? I'm not going to turn down the free meal. And we just was talking before everybody else pulled up. And it was just one of them things. It was like, man, how you feel? It was like, shit, I feel good. How you feel?
Okay, so now, like, I want to go back a little. How hard is it to walk away? Because for me, I know for me and Tariq, like, yes, we were birds of a feather, best friends in high school, spend a night at each other's couches, you know, whatever, do everything together. And then we start a business with each other, and we're just slowly now, now that we're inching to 50, we're slowly now inching back to where we were when we were 14 and 15. But there was a period between ages 23 to 47.
Damn.
In which we were very committed business partners. And it was like, no matter what, this group is not dying, which doesn't make for good chemistry if you're, you know, if you're making creative products. So it's
staying
like
together for the kids.
Yeah. Is did you feel exactly like a sense of defeat? Did you feel a sense of like a dream deferred once it was like, okay, this group is officially a wrap and just put it on the shelf and you'll go that way and I'll go this way?
I'll let you go, Pooh.
I think for me, that didn't hit till later. At the time when we stopped speaking, I think I was I was so pissed, and I think we were so just frustrated at just a bunch of things in turn each other that it was more like, well, fuck that shit. I'm going to show this nigga. And later on,
for real,
it started to really sink in, like, yo, whoo, I think we fucked up, but it's too late to turn back now. We down this path. Like,
yeah, it was. I didn't realize it. I think, you know, at the time when we, you know, just said fuck it, I was just tired, you know what I mean? And I just, you know, we had spent so many years just kind of in a pressure cooker together, just album, mixtape, tour, mixtape, album, tour. And I was just fucking exhausted, man. And so at the time when we said, you know, it was over, I was like, okay, well, you know, we hadn't really been, you know, because a lot of people ask, well, if the record, if you think if the record would have sold better, y'all would have stayed together. The thing about it at the time when we broke up in Ninth left in 07, and then 20, me and Pooh called
it 2010.
At that time, that was when we were seeing some of our best shows. So, you know, after Get Back, that was when we got a really big black audience. So yeah, our shows were still going up. Like, we were doing really good business on the road. And, you know, we could have kept, you know, going out there and getting that money. But I think it was a combination of just exhaustion and then just, it wasn't fun. Like, we just weren't enjoying each other. We weren't enjoying the experience. We were literally just coming on stage, just rap, 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 and then we would go off in two separate directions. And for me, you know, you got to make money. Money is important. But the minute this shit start feeling like a job, nigga, I'm gone. I didn't get in this shit because I wanted to work a job. I could have kept my job. You know, I got in this to, you know, make a living and be around people I love and us build something together. And once the shit became work, it was like, man, fuck this.
It was just hard just looking at the scene at the time. And it was like, yo, this shit is wide open. This is what we fought all them fucking years for, is to get to this point. And we got here. We're the man in the cave. That all we had to do was take that pitchfork and hit that dirt one more time, and the diamond was there.
All the diamond, yeah.
But we turned around and walked away. We're that guy. Like, that's how I felt. Just how everything turned around, and I was just like, damn, we missed an opportunity there. But like you said, man, we just exhausted, man. Just with right. each other, with the situation, with just everything. It was just like, man, I just need time to go be free over here by myself or doing some other shit.
And for me, Get Back, that was our last album. We owe ABB. And after that, that was like freedom. I felt freedom in a way that I hadn't felt in a long time. And that was when I was like, nigga, fuck a label. Like, fuck, we out this deal. We free of Atlantic, ABB. Man, fuck this shit. And that was when me and Nick formed FE Music after that.
Okay. All right, so everyone that listens to the show knows Fonte's disdain for me holding on tightly to politically correct non-gotcha questions.
Uh-oh.
Go in, son. We can talk about whatever. We in the age of the Rona, nigga. Well, they ain't gonna hold it back now. Shit.
The age of the Rona.
So, should I will publicly into the future a reunion of the original unit of this group?
Well, I can tell you this.
Damn, you already started. Okay.
you can say out loud and put into the air as much as you want, brother Amir. I can tell you what ain't gonna happen.
listen. But wait, just hear me out.
Okay,
hear me out. Hear me out.
I know my answer already, but I listen.
Because I believe, okay, for those that never heard the Solange episode, I went on Twitter, I think in, I was at least at Fallon at the time. It's so like 2010?
12, 13. This was later than that. This was about 20.
This when you and Solange got into it, Tay? This when you and Solange got into it? That was about 12, 13-ish.
I decided, you know what? I'm going to publicly will a little brother reunion for the greater good. You know, the road to hell is paved with great intentions.
Facts.
So I put a tweet out there. I was like, I forget the exact wording, but it's like, I'm willing a little brother reunion because damn it, I need it. And, you know, Fonte kind of did the, you remember when Chappelle
I tried
does,
to walk away,
JFK
man. I was like, nah, man, chill. Don't do that, chill. I tried to defuse the bomb. And
you did it like, yo, man, my wife was here. Like, Nigga, what are you doing? Like, that sort of thing. He gave an example of, like, yo, man, this is like me putting out there, like, you and Solange and da-da-da-da-da. And then Solange saw her name, says, wait, me and Amir, what? And then it caused... Yeah,
what a time.
I saw all that. I saw all the fireworks, nigga. Pow, pow, pow.
Yeah. Yeah, because me and Pooh weren't even talking at that time. We weren't talking at that time, but that shit went off. That shit was crazy.
My whole point was that this still happened, and you said it would never happen. So that's it.
So if that never happened, is it a possibility?
What were you saying, Pooh?
Back to my answer. That was a nice story. like, this is the thing,
Pooh,
man.
Pooh with the baby face shade.
Yeah, this is the thing. When we came back this time, we realized the fundamental differences as men. And you can't get past that.
Facts.
Like, he is who he is. We are who we are. And we see things differently than the way he does. And the clarity is there. And that's just it. Like, because for me, the thing I always said about Little Brother, even when we weren't talking, when we weren't making music, the magic in the music was that it was our relationship. It wasn't the fact that Tay dope, I'm dope, Night Beats were dope. It's our relationship. It's the way we approach records, the way we made records. You can hear the joy in the records. In our later records, you can start to not hear that joy.
Yeah, and little by little, yeah.
Little by little, it was gone. And so... when we came back to do, which ended up being Made a Little Watch, me and Tay had a talk. And it basically was like, listen, man, we here to do this for each other. We here to have fun doing this shit. And nigga, anything more than that, it's whatever. Like, we ain't here for it. And we realized very quickly that we saw things that way. He did not. And so it's just like, yo, we good. Like, we're good. Like, we're good.
When's the last time you guys have spoken to Ninth?
2018. For me, it was.
I talked to him more than you.
It was 2018.
You was 2018. For me, it was 2019. It was March 2019.
Yeah, because it was around the time Nip died. And
Yeah.
It was March 2019. But yeah, for me, 2018. The last time we actually saw each other, like saw each other, was when the night we performed. Gig,
yeah.
At Art of Cool Festival. Yeah. So August 2018, that was the last time we saw each other.
And that performance was just someone saying, hey, who was missing? Who was supposed to? Royce. The show. Royce.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Royce missed. And then,
who was the person that was the point person who reached out to who?
It was my man Suleiman Mossy. He's a promoter, and he runs now. He owns the Art of Cool Festival, which is a music festival that goes on down here in Durham. And Royce missed his flight, and me and Suleiman, you know, we had a working relationship. He had booked Foreign Exchange a bunch of times, so we knew each other just, you know, over the years. And so he reached out to me and was like, "Yo, man, Royce missed his flight. Do you want to do a solo set?" And I'm literally at home in, you know, a t-shirt and my boxers, just like doing nothing. And I said, let me check and see if it's even possible. So I ended up making the calls. I called, reached out to Flash, who was my tour DJ first. He didn't get an answer for him. So then I reached out to Ninth. And me and Ninth had been hanging in Durham that previous night. So I hit him. I was like, hey, man, Suleiman hit me about wanting to do this show. You know, would you DJ for me? And he was like, yeah, I'll DJ for you. And I said, man, you know what would be crazy? Man, what if we get Pooh involved in this shit? And he was like, oh, hell. I mean, he was super reluctant about it. But, you know, I you know, kind of twisted his arm. And he was like, all right, cool. You know, I'll do it. And I called Pooh and hit Suleiman back. And we got everything sorted out. And so that all came together within a matter of 3-4 hours. I mean, it was super, super fast. And that was it. I mean, that was kind of what started it. And that was the last time
And at the end, it wasn't like, yo, I enjoyed that. It was awesome.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, the funny part about it was foreshadowing in life. I didn't see him when it was over. Me and Tay, no lie, no bullshit. Like, me and Tay walked back up to the RVs, which were our trailers, and he didn't, because he went down there to the stage before we did, and he didn't go back up when we went up. And I ain't seen him since we walked off that stage. We took like two pictures together, and then I was like, man, fuck this. I ain't got to stay down here taking all these pictures. I'm going upstairs to get drunk. Like, and Tay was like, nigga, I'm going upstairs too. And we went upstairs, and I haven't seen him since. Like, no lie. No cap, man. As the young people say. No cap.
Not a cap. Not a cap at all. No cap, no fedora, no none of that shit.
All
right, man.
He couldn't.
2022, I'm getting y'all a life coach.
We don't need one, man. We good.
Nah, not for this. I mean, if you want to have a life coach, just talk about childhood trauma and shit like that. We can talk about that.
Yeah, but that's something totally different. We good on this. We don't work this out. We don't work
all the way
out.
Okay. All right.
Good try, though, man. Wishful. I feel you, man.
Wishful thinking.
Hey, you know.
No. I'll take it. Look, this is official Little Brother reunion. I'll take it. The album is banging.
Thank you, man.
Happy to have been a part of it.
Thank you.
So what happens? Okay, so obviously we're in the age of the Rona now, where all the breaks have suddenly halted on our professional lives. And, you know, what happens now? Is this time for a new album? Is it?
We making it through the Rona, man. That's all you can do right now.
Yeah, one day at a time. Yeah, one day. Yeah.
You know, people always ask us about another album, man. And it's one for us. It's just one of them things where it's like,
let's be like, you lucky you got the one you got.
Not only that, but like, we both have just a lot of other things that we have going on, and you know, like I manage full time, so
right.
Luckily, Big Doe, my partner, so he was able to pick up a lot of that slack. And
And what is that into now, Pooh, being a manager, being a soup?
Listen, man, let me tell you something, bro. This shit will... you can't see him in the camera, but I got a lot of grays down here now, man. Got a lot of grays, man. It's, you know, it's for me, it's just one of them things, man. I just love music, and I love the guys that I have, and I believe in them full force. And I just want to see them accomplish some of the things that they want to accomplish, if not everything. So I'm here, I'm ride or die. That's why I don't have a lot of clients, man. Like, I gotta feel goosebumps when I hear you for the first time. And all these guys, I had that feeling, but it's hard, man. It's stressful. It's three different people, three different personalities, three different levels in their careers right now. Mm-hmm. And
but you're using the wisdom.
All the wisdom.
Right. But everything that you have.
But this is the thing.
How old are they?
30, 31, and 24.
Ooh. Youngin.
Yeah. And this is the thing I tell people.
Y'all just old.
I have a lot of wisdom, right? I have a lot of wisdom. But this is their careers. So I don't rule with the iron fist. I'm more of a, let's have a conversation about whatever the situation is. Let's weigh the pros, the cons. I'll give you my advice. I'll give you some, you know, some anecdotes if I have any. But at the end of the day, you have to make a choice for you, because it's your career. And I'm going to ride whatever that choice is, whether I agree or not. But it has to be your choice, because you got to go out here and sell this shit.
Exactly. Yeah, we were always kind of on some, when it came to us dealing with other acts, whatever, we were always kind of on some tie goes to the runner shit. Just in the sense of, you know, like he said, I was like, I can have my thoughts about it, but if it's a song you believe in, you the one that's got to walk out here on this shit, not me. It's your name that's attached to it. So I could hate the fucking song, but if you love it and this what you believe in, then I'll stand behind you on it, because it's you the one that's got to sell it.
Yeah. And it's going to follow you sometimes around for the rest of your life. Don't.
It's going to follow you around. I think the best thing for
not me.
The best thing for me in my position is, I have a legacy that's cemented. Whether I stop today and just go back to being Thomas Jones and go work at the airport or some shit, like, my legacy is cemented already. So I don't have that fear of the fuck up. And it's just like, yo, let's go. Let's go fast. Let's go hard. And if we fuck up along the way, it's going to happen. Mistakes going 100 and mistakes going 10 is two different type of mistakes. Let's go 100. And that's just that's what we do.
Yeah. Yeah, I was thinking we had Jimmy Jam on, you know, the other day, and you know, he was talking about how his wife, you know, how he got involved in the Grammys and stuff, and it was his wife that was telling him, like, yo, this is what you're supposed to be doing now. You know what I mean? And that really resonated with me because it kind of reminded me, I think that was a lot of what me and Pooh would have conversations with about Made a Lord Watch. One of the earliest conversations we had after we finished the record, the first thing we thought about was, okay, who can we help? Like, now that we've done this, how can we use this new platform we have to, you know, jump somebody else off or help, you know, someone else? And so when it comes to, you asked about doing another album, for me, you know, that record just took a lot. Like, it took everything out of me.
Everything.
Because it was so much we knew we had to get right. And I mean, you know, and you always, you know, not to say that it's ever been, you know, records that we have stepped on or like purposely just did some bullshit or whatever. I mean, we always put our best foot forward. But with Made a Lord Watch, that was just a draining process because we did everything ourselves. You know what I mean? We cleared our samples. We were budget, label, studio, the whole nine. You know what I'm saying? So it just took so much out of us both. And I think in terms of us doing another record, for me, it really just came down to I just wanted us to do something so where now the air is out of the room. So now if I just want to jump on a song for his album or he jump on some of my album, we can just do a fucking song and that be the end of it. There's no more discussion of, oh, well, what does this mean? And nigga, just mean we did a song together. You know what I mean? So we have the freedom to do that now. And if another record comes, if we feel like we got something else to say, you know, we can do that. But as of right now, speaking for me, I'm just kind of enjoying the peace of just having, you know, my brother back in my life again and us being able to use our influence to help other people. Like, that's the most, that's the most joy, the joyous part of it for me.
And we still got cities we ain't touched yet because of the Rona, man.
Straight up.
We ain't been to New York, Houston, Detroit, Toronto, Detroit, Boston. We ain't did a show at the crib since the festival. Like, man, y'all ain't getting no album till that happened. 2025.
Hey, man, look, a bird in the hand, a bird in the hand, beats two in the bush. I mean, I wanted a new Little Brother record.
And you got it.
I got a Christmas gift. I'm not being greedy. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening, man.
Yeah, man. Oh, and I always wanted to thank you, Amir, for, I don't know if you remember, but we did a show at the TLA. This is the listening time. And you came to the show. And
I know exactly what you're talking about. I remember
that. You said, yo, I want to buy some CDs from y'all. And we said, okay, how many you want? You paid for 30 CDs. You left them CDs there.
I did.
So we were able to resell them CDs with their money in hand. And we needed that money. So I always, I never got to thank you for that.
Wow. I think I did that on purpose. That's a very Amir thing to do. Hey. But I think I also did it on purpose.
$7 got niggas back down 95.
Sure did. Sure did.
All right. Well, look, I'm wrapping up the show, man. Wait, but Bill, you usually have a trick in your
head. I'm good.
Oh, thank you, Bill. Yo, I want to thank y'all for doing this show. You know, under these circumstances, I never thought I'd get the Little Brother episode.
But you know what, though, man? On some real, and this is just my mind working post-edible. How poetic is it that we all met on the internet and now we're doing our show on the internet?
We're doing the internet.
Don't you tell me what my God can't do.
Won't he do it?
It's only right. Well, on behalf of Big Pooh, Fonticolo, Boss Bill, the rest of Team Supreme, Laia, Sugar Steve, Unpaid Bill, and Fonticolo. Oh, my God. I was about to see you out getting cigarettes. Anyway.
I'm back now.
Oh, you good. All right, this is Questlove, and thank you for tuning in, and we will see you on the next go-round of Questlove Supreme. Thank you. Peace. Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.